All right, Genesis 24. I'd like to go through this probably quicker than I'll be able to, but I'm going to try to, I really want to get through 24, 25, and maybe into 26 this afternoon. We'll see how we do. But as we were talking last week, we were looking at the death of Sarah in 23 and the purchase of the burial cave for Abraham's family. Now, we'll note that Sarah, really kind of unique in Scripture. She's the only woman who, her lifespan is placed in Scripture, which is unique for her. Peter extols her virtues in talking to wives of his day and of our day. And so there's much to consider about Sarah's life and about the legacy of faith that she's left behind. As we come into chapter 24, you have Abraham now entering a new world, a world without Sarah. She has been a huge part of his life. Isaac as well. Isaac at this point is 37 years old. He's yet to marry. And you have Abraham, how old? That's a easy math, isn't it? Just add 100. So he's 137 at the time Sarah passes. Verse or chapter 24, verse 1 just opens this way. Now, Abraham was old. It's an interesting way to kind of reintroduce him, but it says, well advanced in years, and the Lord blessed Abraham in all things. And Abraham said to his servant, the oldest of his household, of his house, who had charge of all that he had. Do we know who that is? Eliezer. You remember earlier, before Isaac, before Ishmael, it was Eliezer that Abraham had asked the Lord to bless, right? And to allow him to become his inheritor. And God said no, of course. But the reason this is probably Eliezer is because when someone didn't have an heir, a biological heir, it would go to their oldest living servant. And that would have been Eliezer. Well, so this, although he's not named in the text, that's most likely the case unless he's passed. And we just don't know about it. But most likely Eliezer. So he brings Eliezer in. He has him to swear an oath, verse 3. And so he swears an oath to do what? He says, you're to go back to my homeland, which is where? Haran, right? Ur of Chaldees is where they originally were, and then they moved to Haran or Haran. And there is where God calls him out of Haran to go to the land of Canaan, where he is currently. And so he wants him to go back to his kinsmen. Do you know which group of kinsmen? Which brother's family? Nahor. Now, at this point, Nahor's passed, but his family is still living in Haran, or right in the vicinity of Haran. And so he has his oldest, his servant here, to go back to find a wife. Now, I think it's kind of interesting. Death sometimes makes us to reevaluate life, and it may spur us on to take care of things that we've left undone. One of the things that's been left undone is what? Isaac doesn't have a wife. He's 37, still unmarried. And so at that time, it was, and there's still some cultures today where this is the case, but the father really had charge to find a bride for his son. And so this is one of those things that Abraham needed to take care of. And so he's going to send his son back to Haran to find that bride. It's interesting, why not just find him a bride in the place where he lived?
Mm-hmm. allow them to live, they're going to influence your behavior.
Absolutely.
Abraham may well have seen that and said, I'm not going to see anybody around here that I want to be my son's wife.
Yeah, good point. And when we get to the law of Moses in Exodus and maybe Deuteronomy, it mentions explicitly that the Israelites were not to intermarry. Now, at this point, we have no recording that I'm aware of anywhere in Genesis where God said to Abraham, you're not to intermarry. Yet, as Doug mentioned, he doesn't want to do that. He wants not a wife from the Canaanites, but a wife from his kinsmen. Now, in what we've already studied, have we seen some evidence that they are a pretty immoral group of people in Canaan? I mean, what just happened with Lot's situation, right? And Sodom and Gomorrah is not the only immoral place. So, are the people in Haran holy? No, they're not living holy, but it seems as though they were less immoral than those of Canaan. And so he wants to go back. Now, what's interesting is his other children, Abraham will marry again, and he'll have other sons. They will intermarry. But for Isaac, that will not happen.
It seems, if I go to my reading and stuff like that too, there's an indication that the people back in Haran worshiped their religious lives. Will they worship a god, where many of the people in Canaan were,
polytheistic. Well, that gets kind of complicated because later on, we know that Laban is polytheistic. And it seems to be that where his family was in Ur and later even in Haran, that they were polytheistic too, polytheistic. But we will note something interesting later in 24, which I'm moving slower than I want to, but we'll note that they do acknowledge Yahweh. Laban himself will acknowledge Yahweh, even though later in Genesis, he'll be noted as a polytheist. So, and when I'm saying polytheist, I should define that. It's a one who believes in more than one God. Like you might think about Greek mythology or Roman mythology, the Romans, the Greeks, many other people, that even today in India, in China, China's a lot of atheists, but in India, there's very much a polytheistic kind of culture. So, was do you have a question, Kim?
Well, I was wondering, this is probably what it is. But if Isaac was the only one that God would deal with there, not having his children or wife, and the rest of them, why?
Well, so at this point, Isaac is it. That is his only child. Now he'll have children later on with his when he remarries. But at this point, it's Isaac. Well, and then there's Ishmael. I don't forget about Ishmael. Sorry, there is Ishmael. He has married and intermarried with the people of the land as well. But Isaac, it's not to be that way. So Abraham sets up this pact, if you will, with his servant. He has him swear to it, this oath. He says, though, this oath is contingent on something. The servant would be released if what? Do you remember? You may read ahead in the text. Yeah. If the young lady that who's been appointed for Isaac is unwilling to come, then Abraham says, you're free, right? You don't have to fulfill this oath. And so that's kind of the stipulation. I'm not going to get into the bridal price, but you will see that the servant will take many goods and valuables with him, costly things. And that was customary of the day. The husband's father would give a dowry to the bride's father. And so that's what he's doing as you read that. There's a lot of repetition in this chapter, so I'm not going to just rehash the whole thing. But he does travel. If you go on in the text, so it says he went to Mesopotamia to the city of Nahor. Now you will, if you see up on the map, I don't know where my clicker is, but If you go up to Padanaram, you see Haran there, kind of at the top. That's the area. Now, whether Nahor represented Haran itself or like a city near it, I'm not exactly sure, but it was right there at Haran is where he's traveling. So you can see there you see Shechem, that area around Shechem, Bethel, all down to Hebron. That's kind of where he's traveling from, and he's going to go back north up to Haran. So he's got a pretty good distance. Later he'll identify it as like a 10-day journey, although that's not literal 10 days. It's kind of a symbolic way of saying he has a long journey to get back south. So he's having to travel up. He does so. Let's go down. So verse 11, it says, and he made the camels kneel. So they've come near the city, just outside the city by the well of water at the time of evening. So it's late in the day. Now, again, how do they measure time? I don't know if they measured exactly like the Jews did, but I imagine they did, that the evening would be the beginning of a new day. That's how they would measure it. And so you're seeing them come to the close of one day and move into the next. They kneel down at the time of evening, the time when what? When the women would go out to draw the water. So one of the tasks that the ladies would have, and it's probably young women, would be to come get the water. Now, why would they come in the evening? Weather, right? You wouldn't want to come in the midday. Kind of interesting when you go to John 4, Jesus meets that woman at noon at the midday when it was the hottest. Well, why was she coming out there? Well, she was a woman who didn't have a very good reputation in the city. And so she came out when she, I'm guessing, when she thought she'd be alone. Well, the custom was not to come at midday, but in the evening. And she would come to draw water. Now notice what he says, verse 12. And he said, O Lord, God of my master Abraham, please grant me success today and show steadfast love to my master Abraham. You do note there the relationship between the servant and his master. They have a good relationship. And I think that's a demonstration of his affection for Abraham. Behold, I am standing by the spring of water, and the daughters of the men of the city are coming out to draw water. Let the young woman who, to whom I shall say, please let down your jar that I may drink, and who shall say, drink, and I will water your camels. Now just that portion there. Oh, I'm sorry. Let me finish this out. Let her be the one whom you have appointed for your servant Isaac. What do you see right here about God? This is God's what? Providence. This is God's providence. The servant, does he have any idea who the woman's going to be? You don't even see him looking out at the women to pick one, does he? He allows it to be a God's choice. Exactly. I think that's pretty neat, isn't it? He is completely letting God have it. And because he knows it's ultimately God's choice. And so Rebecca didn't just by chance happen there. God's hand is all on this. You also see that in the way she, in the scenario that the servant has set up. Do you see how the conditions have been set by him? As why is he saying that to God? And for confirmation, right? If this is the way it happens, because he puts that interesting stipulation that not only does she allow him to drink, but she is to do what? He's not going to ask her to water the camels. She is going to volunteer it. So in other words, how could he, how could this be any way on him? It's not, is it? It's on God through her. And so Let's see.
It says a lot about the character of the young woman. Mm-hmm. His wife for Isaac is going to have to be a very special woman because she's going to be marrying into this. She's got a huge role to play. So she's going to have to be very hospitable and, you know, I mean, can you imagine watering 10 camels? That sounds like a lot of water.
Yes. It's a lot of work what she's getting ready to do. I love the similarities between this situation and that later. We'll see. But anyway, we'll get to later in Genesis and when we get there. But so, verse 15, before he had finished speaking, here comes Rebecca. Rebecca comes out. I'm not going to read the whole thing. Please do that in your personal Bible study. But she does exactly what was the scenario that the servant had asked of God. Which again, I want to note one other thing about the servant. It also shows that he has a like faith to Abraham. He has a like faith. You see the influence of Abraham on the servant and what the servant has seen God do with Abraham. So he's obviously a believer in God. Yeah, and I don't mean just faith in a generic sense, right? But he has a real, seemingly personal faith in God. It's not just something he inherited because he was a servant, but it seems more real to me in reading the text.
God's involved in my life every day. Mm-hmm. Every decision I'm making is sort of what it looks like to me.
Absolutely.
That's real recognition that God's not just an abstract. He's here. He's involved in my life all the time.
Yeah. Absolutely. So again, she does exactly what had been laid out. It does say in verse 16, now notice again, he didn't look out across the women and pick her, but what does it say? She was very attractive. She's a beautiful lady. Whatever that meant for Isaac, she was very beautiful. She was a maiden. So anyway, as you read out afterwards, he gives her, verse 22, a golden ring. This would have been a nose ring that she would have worn. And then he also gives her bracelets. And it says bracelets weighing 10 gold shekels. A shekel is about four tenths of an ounce. So these would have been substantial bracelets. again, an ornament of the day. There are some ladies who may have nose rings, but that's not very present, right? No ladies in here have nose rings, I don't think. But for them, that was part of their adorning. Excuse me, I'm sorry. And so he does find out that she is of the household of Abraham's kinsman. She is the daughter of who? Bethuel, right? Bethuel. Now, Bethuel will have two children of note. One is Rebekah. Who's the other? Laban. Laban is Rebekah's brother. Laban will come back up. I'm sorry, my throat. She does invite him to the home. Again, I'm not going to cover this. A lot of repetitive stuff here. He'll relate to the household of Laban and Bethel and Laban, the things that had happened. I did want to note one thing. So one of the things... which is pretty significant, right? And it lets us know the urgency he felt to accomplish the ends here. That he said, I've got to get my business done first. I know I've been traveling, and it would be great to sit down and relax and to eat a meal probably, but I've got to do this. And so he's going to take care of it. Good point, Doug. There was something I wanted to...
I'm thinking of too, just for him, what comes up, his his departure the next day, sort of that, to me, sort of makes his point to her family that that's why I want to go.
Yes.
God brought me here. God gave me what we were after. Now it's time for me to go back. I don't need to labor around here. I came for a purpose. God answered it. Now it's time for me to leave.
Yeah, and we see that right as the as we get out of this chapter, almost at the end there. I want to note one thing about Laban. We'll note later on Laban's greed, especially when it comes to Jacob and what he does to Jacob unfairly. But you kind of get probably a little bit of a glimmer of where he is when he sees the gold on his sister, noting the wealth. Also, the other thing is the wealth of Abraham. Now, the Bible never gives us a full appreciation of how wealthy he was. It never gives us an accounting of it. But he must have been a very wealthy man, which is interesting. He owned one piece of property, and it was a burial tomb. That was it. But he had to have had tremendous wealth. Again, we think about the money he paid to buy the burial tomb and how much that was. I mean, tremendous amount of money. He was a very wealthy man, most likely. And so you note that as you read this.
With what he would have for money-wise, wouldn't that be what God would make sure that he had?
It's all God's blessing on Abraham. Well, I would say Abraham definitely was, and he proved that right many times over. But the offering of his son really proved how wealthy he was in his faith. But he also had physical wealth as well. And so that's another thing about, you know, Rebecca. She's becoming the wife of promise. She doesn't really understand that yet. She'll understand that later, I think, as time moves. But she is not going into poverty here. She's not going to be marrying the pauper son, right? But the son of the king, the prince, in one kind of sense.
Part of his wealth came from deceit too. And the Bible doesn't really have anything that says any negative comments that I can recall related to that. As he was going through Canaan and part of the animals, and a lot of the wealth was measured in the size of it.
Mm-hmm.
Represented his wife as a sister.
Oh, yeah.
She was half sister, but he didn't bring all that out. You know, he was just worried about his own skin. And, you know, you're so worried and all that stuff. He'll kill me and take you.
Yeah.
You know, so why don't you tell him you're my sister instead? And so he's deceitful, but he got a lot of stuff because kings and all that, he paid him extra to give, you know?
And that really came because of God dispensed, not blessing because of his deceit, but blessing in spite of his deceit. Hopefully at this point in his life he's overcome that deceitfulness, but we know early on he's not, at least in regard to Sarah, he's not always been very truthful about that. Yes, ma'am.
When you say that, I think, you know, in the Bible it says love covers a multitude of sins, and I always think of that whenever we do something that we know wasn't right, but God just kind of, but we know he knows that. We had a reason for our own thinking that we thought maybe, you know, that we were doing the right thing, even though, and so we're kind of.
I'm thankful for God's grace to cover my weakness and sin, right, and that he didn't destroy me as I probably deserved. So anyway, the text, as you go out, Rebecca agrees to travel back. Again, as Doug has already kind of mentioned about, he doesn't wait around. He's not like, I need to be on my way. She does agree to go, and they end up leaving and traveling back. It says at the time, Isaac was dwelling in the Negev. Now, that's a long journey. So the Negev, you'll see Shur there. The Negev was there right around... You see that kind of Shur, Edom, Paran area, that area in between. The Negev was down in that area. So you see how far they've traveled from Haran all the way down into the Negev. And it's there that she sees him walking across the field. She will ask, who is this? And then what does she do? She gets down off the horse and then she covers herself up, which was a thing of modesty of the day. That's what you would do as a maiden. Yeah. Again, we've mentioned this before, but the marriage process for them, as compared to us, was a much longer process. And at the moment she agreed to leave Haran, she was betrothed to Isaac. So, and in one sense, they're already married, although the consummation of the marriage was not take place for a while. Now, to give you kind of an idea of how long or when this took place, later in chapter 25, we find out that Isaac is 40 years old, so when they married. And so it's been about 3 years since Sarah's passing. So that process of sending the servant going there, of bringing her back and them marrying, took about 3 years in the process of doing that. He's 40. Abraham was about 140 years old. I'm going to shut up in just 1 second. Let me just say this. I didn't get in as far as I wanted, but I do want to mention 25, the beginning there. It says, Abraham took another wife whose name was Keturah. I guess I want to say more about her. So I'll just wait. We'll cover 25 next time and get into 26. A good study, good conversation. Any other things before I close?
I want to say something, but it is referring to her forgetting.
What is it, real quick?
Well, I know she's a concubine, mm-hmm. and I know that, you know, that was fairly common, you know, during their day. Mm-hmm. But it, you know, kind of like a secondary wife.
Yeah. I don't know of any indication how God felt one way or the other.
Yeah, at this point.
Yeah, and Sarah's been gone now for a few years. Now, I don't know exactly. It doesn't say how old he was when he married her. But if I'm just going by the marriage laws we see in Matthew 19 and later in the New Testament, he would have been more than free to marry her. Right. I think that the more in... Yeah, I need to look at that. They could be. This is, and I don't know this, so you, everybody research, you can dig at the answer yourself. My understanding is it could be a wife, it's like a wife of secondary status, or it could just simply be a slave who was given charge over the wife, or charged to serve the wife, right? And the reason I think that's probably the case with her is in the instance of Ishmael and his mom, and I'm sorry, her name is just fleeting my brain. Hagar, thank you. Sarah had to insist on him going into her, as though implying in my mind that was not something he did. He did not go into other women, to be with other women in an intimate way like that. And so it would be from that. My understanding right now is, in my study of it, is that she was a slave of Abraham. She was a servant of Sarah. Oh, you're welcome. Good question. Any others?
She wouldn't,
but in the culture, she would have been seen as a a wife of second standing, right? She's not like, she would not have been held on the same level as Sarah. And that's it gets into a really deep cultural study of the day, but that's the way it was.
So
now,
the sons would be the same thing, right?
What now?
The sons would be basically the same thing.
They would be looked at differently. And when you look at the text, Isaac is held up above all of the sons, Ishmael and all the sons of Ketur. Can you say their name? Ketur, right? Ketur. They, even though he has several of them, it's Isaac who gets all of the inheritance. Now, he gives him some gifts, but Isaac gets the inheritance. Good questions, great questions. Don't have all the answers, but maybe it'll spur our study on. Now, concubines, when you get to Solomon, a lot of those were wives of a second nature. That, I think, is a very different situation than the one with Abraham. And just because something, I want to say this real quick and then we'll move on. Just because something happens in the Bible, does it mean God endorses it? This is a big thing that agnostics and atheists, critics of the Bible, try to claim against the Bible. Just because it's there and just because people of God did a thing does not mean God endorses the thing they do. Unless it's commanded by God, then you can say, well, that's something God endorses. But even like the lies that you see with Abraham, or you see with Rahab or other characters, just because they did it does not mean God was okay with it.
And that's part of my question.
Mm-hmm.
Was this something that God endorsed? Probably.
The Bible leaves that kind of silent. I would think just based on marriage laws, as we see them in the New Testament, I think he would be, because Sarah is passed now. And so he would be not held to that marriage law that he had been with Sarah. And that's why what happened with Hagar was a violation of that. Good questions. Well, and it's one of the strongest evidences for the inspiration of the Bible is that it doesn't just leave us clean, holy, purified examples. It shows us the dirtiness of people, like the evil things they did as well, godly people. Right? That actually speaks to the authenticity, because if a human was to write it, if Moses was writing on his own, he's probably not going to include all the bad things Abraham did. Like, he'd be like, why not include that? Let me just say the good things. Good point, Doug. Good point. Good questions from everybody. Again, thank you.